watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Three-card Monte is a con game that presents itself as a game of chance. On street corners in every major city, confidence men make their living with three bent playing cards and an understanding of human behavior. The victim is asked to pick, out of the three cards sliding around the table, the one red card. The dealer tells you he will double your money if you win. First, he shows you two black suit playing cards and one red. Then he asks to see your bet. He tries not to use words like cash, money, dollars, or any synonym. He wants to bring you in easy. So he slides the cards around. You lay down your money. You pick the card you think is red. He turns it over. It's black. He takes your money. The key is this. After he showed you he had a red card, he replaced it with a black one. He palmed it. This is the dealer's primary skill. He hides the red one in his large palm, up a sleeve, in a pocket, wherever. You don't notice because your attention is being distracted by his pattern. You don't notice because you are already convinced that one of the three cards sliding around the table is red. There is, in actuality, no red card for you to choose. Analysts that we have presented over the last several weeks on this program have explained why the so-called war on terrorism is not only unlikely to eliminate terrorism, but rather it will increase the pool of people worldwide who have suffered at the hands of the U.S. government, thereby resulting in increased risk that these people will turn to terrorism to address their grievances. Are the war on terrorism's stated objectives the real objectives? What is the war on terrorism actually accomplishing? Tonight on the program, we'll look at how it is boosting the political fortunes of the Bush administration, being used to force through controversial energy and trade policies, giving the state increased power to attack political dissent and democratic freedoms, increasing the U.S. military presence in oil-rich countries, and, in spite of the calls for unity, fueling racism within American society. Remember last November's presidential election where George Bush failed to gain the majority of the popular vote? Where his Electoral College majority was also called into question by allegations of a variety of voting irregularities in Florida, a state governed by candidate Bush's brother Jeb, the quashing of hand recounts by the Supreme Court voting along party lines, with the majority Republican-appointed justices ruling to stop the recounts and thereby declaring Bush president? And do you remember the consortium of media organizations that announced that they intended to perform an independent recount of questionable Florida ballots? Press in Australia and the United Kingdom are reporting that the count is complete and that the sponsoring news organizations have decided to withhold the results from the public. Here's what the Australian Daily, the Sydney Morning Herald, reported on October 22nd. The title of the article is, Media Suppressed the News That Bush Lost Election to Gore. The most detailed analysis yet of the contested Florida votes from last year's presidential election, with the potential to question President Bush's legitimacy, is being withheld by the news organizations that commissioned it. Results of the inspection of more than 170,000 votes rejected as unreadable in the hanging Chad chaos of last November's vote count were ready at the end of August. Since study was commissioned early this year by a consortium including the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and the New York Times, and the broadcaster CNN, the cost was more than $2 million. Now, however, spokesmen for the consortium say that they decided to postpone the story of the analysis by the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago for lack of resources and lack of interest in the face of the enormous story after the September 11th attacks. Newspapers were saying last week that the final phase of the analysis, counting the 170,000 votes, had been postponed. Quote, "Our belief is that the priorities of the country have changed, and our priorities have changed," unquote, said Stephen Goldstein, Vice President of Corporate Communications at Dow Jones, owner of the Wall Street Journal. Catherine Mathis, a spokeswoman for the New York Times, said, "The consortium agreed that because of the war, because of our lack of resources, we were postponing the vote count investigation. But this is not final. The intention is to go forward," close quote. However, David Podvin, an investigative journalist who runs an independent web page, Make Them Accountable, said he'd been tipped off that the consortium was covering up the results. He refused to disclose his source other than to describe him as a former media executive whom he knew as, quote, "an accurate conduit of information," and who claimed that the consortium is deliberately hiding the results of its recount because Gore was the indisputable winner. He also claims that a New York Times journalist involved in the recount project had told a former companion that the Gore victory margin was big enough to create major trouble for the Bush presidency if this ever gets out. The goosiness, the sensitivity that the press which organized this analysis is now showing to publishing the results, and the persistence of questions about the Florida ballots raise questions, said Dr. John Mason, a professor of political science at William Patterson University in New Jersey. There is a sensitivity over the legitimacy of this president. National Opinion Research Center staff have been puzzled by the idea that the media would lack the resources because, they said, they had computer programs already designed and fitted for the final count. And that was from the October 22nd edition of the Sydney Morning Herald, "Media Suppress the News That Bush Lost Election to Gore." Prior to the September 11th attacks, the Bush administration was fighting an uphill battle to put through two pieces of legislation, Bush's energy bill and authorization for presidential fast-track authority to approve international trade agreements such as the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Next, two interviews from Between the Lines on the tie-in being made by the administration between these issues and the so-called war on terrorism.
Since September 11th, American media coverage has focused almost exclusively on the terrorist attacks in New York and Washington, and on the subsequent U.S. airstrikes against Afghanistan and the search for Osama bin Laden. One of the important stories to fall by the wayside was the attempt by the Bush administration and many in Congress to authorize oil drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, or ANWR. That is, until Bush himself raised the issue last week in calling for the passage of his energy bill as a national security measure. The administration's proposal calls for increased oil and gas drilling and coal mining to make the U.S. less dependent on foreign energy sources. Meanwhile, the average fuel economy for 2002 model cars was lower than for last year's models. Paradoxically, the White House has opposed raising these standards. In August, the House voted in favor of opening up the Arctic Refuge to drilling, which is estimated to hold just 6 months' national supply of economically recoverable oil. Some opponents of the legislation in the Senate have vowed a filibuster, if necessary, to prevent drilling there. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Melanie Griffin, director of land protection programs with the Sierra Club, about where the legislation now stands and alternative policies that could help wean America from oil and other non-renewable energy sources.
As far as we've seen, all of the the strongest proponents of protecting the refuge remain strong proponents, and have said that they still intend to stop any energy bill that includes Arctic refuge drilling. The oil industry allies in the Senate have been trying to attach Arctic drilling to anything and everything that goes by. They actually tried to stop the military preparedness bill by attaching Arctic drilling, and that was driven back. And then they tried to stop the airline safety bill by attaching Arctic drilling, and that was turned back as well. So they are trying any efforts they can to get this through the Congress. There have been ongoing efforts to look at energy policy in a more reasonable time frame with sort of more sensible, thoughtful debate and discussion, and those are ongoing. I think it's probably not likely that we'll see a bill this year because Majority Leader Daschle has said that he wants energy legislation to move in a more reasonable way and not in a sort of a crisis atmosphere. So they are meeting currently and talking about what might be in an energy bill. Of course, they want to address national security issues, things like the safety of our energy infrastructure, and do that sooner rather than later. But as far as the longer-term energy bill, I think we likely won't see that until next year.
Do you think that the administration and Republicans in Congress are exploiting the tragedy of September 11th to push their energy policy through, to try to push it through more quickly?
I think that there are some in Congress who, unfortunately, are taking advantage of the situation. It's really unfortunate, and we have just been reiterating that we think this is a time for healing and unity, and we ought to be focusing on issues that unite us and on protecting the safety of all Americans and not on the issues that divide us. But unfortunately, there are a few people in Congress who have been pushing this industry-backed agenda and just don't seem to understand how inappropriate that is at this time.
Would you call this, or would the Sierra Club call this, the biggest environmental issue, or the biggest, at least the biggest energy issue facing America right now, the issue of what to do about ANWR?
I think that the Arctic refuge issue represents a very big choice. And so in that sense, yes. Now, obviously, there's some huge issues to be dealt with, nuclear power, safety, electricity generation, renewables. But the bottom line is we have got to get off oil, not just foreign oil, oil. We only sit on less than 3% of the world's oil. So we are never going to be energy independent if we depend on oil. So we need to rely less on oil, not more on oil. And that's why we think any sensible energy bill has to move towards efficiency and renewables with transition in natural gas and get away from oil, not opening up our last wilderness areas to oil drilling instead of going in a new direction. That is the past. We need to move forward, and we ought to not leave nothing but devastation in our wake.
What does the Sierra Club say about what it would take to not need ever to go into ANWR, because we could save more oil in you know some period of time by just making cars more efficient?
Yeah, I mean, if we increased our miles per gallon to just 40 miles per gallon, we could save all the oil that we import from the Middle East in a year, and certainly more than we would might be able to get from the Arctic refuge. One of the things that has been coming up a lot is oil drilling advocates say that they can drill in an environmentally sensitive manner that will only affect 2,000 acres. And that has been making some headway in the argument, but people need to actually understand that the 2,000 acres is not just a little confined 2,000-acre area. It would be spread all across the coastal plain of the Arctic Refuge, which is the biological heart of the refuge that's of concern here. It would be just like a web of roads and airstrips and gravel pits and oil wells. It wouldn't just be a little square, which is the way the oil industry is trying to portray it. So you wouldn't just stick down a pipe and be done.
That was Melanie Griffin of the Sierra Club. For more information, call the Sierra Club at area code 202 847-1144 or visit their website at www.sierraclub.org. Before the September 11th terror attacks, the Bush administration's drive to pass a trade promotion authority bill was in trouble. The legislation, formerly known as Fast Track, would grant the president authority to negotiate future international trade deals with minimal debate in Congress and no chance for legislators to propose corrective amendments. But in the days following the assaults on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the Bush administration's trade representative renewed the fight on Fast Track by tying support for free trade with the fight against terrorism. Labor leaders, including AFL-CIO Secretary Treasurer Richard Trumka, condemned the attempt to link passage of Fast Track to patriotism. Fast Track was defeated by a progressive coalition led by the AFL-CIO when President Clinton tried to win congressional approval in 1997. Then, as now, a broad coalition of groups, including family farmers, environmentalists, and human rights activists, have joined with labor to oppose Fast Track. If approved, the Fast Track process would enable the White House to expedite approval of the proposed Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty, or FTAA. FTAA, like the North American Free Trade Agreement, has been criticized for the lack of labor or environmental standards and the power it surrenders to corporations. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Thea Lee, chief international economist with the AFL-CIO, who discusses the campaign to defeat fast-track trade legislation now being considered in the House of Representatives.
Well, the grant of fast-track or trade negotiating authority is something Congress needs to give to the president, because under our Constitution, Congress actually has the right to make trade policy. But for the last couple of decades, Congress has passed that over to the president along with a set of negotiating objectives. And the trade debate has really heated up over the last decade in the United States, and trade policy is more controversial than it's ever been, and so this grant of trade negotiating authority has become very problematic and very difficult, with Congress being unwilling to give over to the president the ability to bring back a trade agreement for an up or down vote when so many important domestic policies might be affected by that. So this vote is very important. I think Congress sees it that way, and the president does too.
Now, the House Republican leadership brought Fast Track back into the thick of things right after the September 11th terror attacks. And in that, I've heard it described that they've wrapped the legislation in the flag, basically saying that Fast Track was a part of the fight against terrorism and a patriotic duty. Can you describe some of your reaction and the reaction of those folks at the AFL-CIO to this strategy on the part of proponents of Fast Track?
Well, it's just unconscionable that the U.S. Trade Representative or Congressman Bill Thomas, who's the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, would somehow try to take advantage of the national tragedy in order to ram through a very divisive trade bill that's going to have a big impact on working people, both in this country and around the world, for many, many years to come. They didn't have the votes to pass Fast Track before September 11th, and the idea that they would use this tragedy and use the so-called fight against terrorism or the need for economic stimulus to try to push a fast-track bill through at this point, I think is actually maddening to a lot of Democrats and some Republicans as well, and it may actually backfire on them, because what we're seeing in the House of Representatives, Democrats are so insulted by this tactic that they are not jumping on board with the fast-track fight. And so we're hoping that it will ultimately backfire and will end without the ability to move forward.
Is there any truth at all that this fast-track negotiating authority is in any way an element in the fight against terrorism? I mean, how do they justify that statement?
Well, it's absurd. And in fact, I think the opposite is true. To the extent that fast-track will facilitate more trade agreements like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, will extend that to the entire hemisphere and will facilitate again or make easier a new round of negotiations with the World Trade Organization. These are policies that have actually been very bad for developing countries, certainly bad for working people or poor people in developing countries. And so we're not likely to gain a lot of supporters around the world in the fight against terrorism simply by ramming through more flawed trade policies that have the same problems as the past. And in terms of the other argument they've made, which is that somehow fast track is necessary to get the world economy going again, this is a ridiculous argument, absurd when you look at the United States. here we are. We've been in a manufacturing recession for over a year now. We've lost over a million manufacturing jobs just in the last 14 months. The idea that what the U.S. economy needs right now is fast-track authority so we can have more NAFTAs and more negotiations at the WTO and let our trade deficits, the excess of imports over exports, go through the roof with even more countries, I think is just ridiculous.
Thea Lee, I wondered if you'd comment on some of the environmental and labor rights provisions in this latest Republican-sponsored bill. Does this do anything to allay the fears of many in the labor movement and the global justice movement that this fast-tracked authority would sell out workers in the environment?
No, the bill that's under consideration now is H.R. 3005. It's the bill introduced by Congressman Thomas, a Republican from California. And even though this bill is being sold as some sort of bipartisan compromise on labor and environment, the truth is it's not bipartisan and it's not a compromise. There are a tiny handful of Democrats who were roped in to work with Representative Thomas on this, and they were not a representative group, and they were certainly not leaders in the Congress. And in terms of the content of the bill, this bill is very little different from all the fast-track bills we've had in the past. It has more words about labor and environment than we've had in the past, but the outcome, the actual results, are going to be no different. All this is, in the Thomas bill, is a negotiating objective. That is, all we're doing is asking our negotiators to go and ask for some very moderate and weak labor provisions, but there's nothing in the bill that would require the negotiators actually to succeed.
That was Thea Lee, chief international economist with the AFL-CIO. Contact the Labor Federation by calling area code 202-637-5000 or visit their website at www.aflcio.org.
That was from Between the Lines, a weekly news program produced at community radio station WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut. On October 15th, a teach-in whose topic was Endless Enemies, U.S. Policy at Home and Abroad, was held at New York University. Next on Unwelcome Guests, we're going to bring you two of the presentations. The first speaker will be Todd Ensign, Director of Citizen Soldier, a GI and Veterans Advocacy and Anti-War Organization. Following Todd Ensign, we'll hear from Christian Parenti, the author of Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis.
Our first speaker is Todd Ensign. He's the director of Citizen Soldier, which is a GI and veterans advocacy group, which was founded in 1969. He's the author of GI Guinea Pigs and Military Life, an Insider's Guide. He's worked with war resistors and conscientious objectors since the Vietnam War. He is also a lawyer and is now working particularly with thousands and thousands of soldiers who were sent into the Middle East who have Gulf War syndrome.
Back in 65, when the Marines went into Da Nang, you remember, that's when we decided to really become involved to begin to displace the Vietnamese as a ground force. It was kind of, in some ways, of course, history never is repeats itself, but in some ways there's some strong parallels to now. By that I mean that we thought then, we didn't really have any real conception of what they, meaning the Pentagon, had in mind. We had no idea about programs like Agent Orange, the massive bombing, which later became, you know, a feature of the war. And so I think it's wonderful that you've turned out tonight, because you can be sure, with a budget of $330 billion a year, that they are very, very assiduously working on a plan and plans to move this enterprise ahead. And what we see right now, like the proverbial camel's nose in the tent, we see just a small part of it. And of course, as you realize, anyone can see Bush on TV, and the dissembling is so obvious, and the attempt to present a facade is apparent, really, to anyone who looks. And so I'm going to sketch out a bit about the Gulf War, because I think it's very, very apropos, and then turn to what I see as a likely phased escalation of this war against, quote, terrorism. Enduring Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom. It may take on other names as it goes forward. So just 5 minutes about the Gulf War, because it's very important. And the reason for that is that not much has really changed in terms of our doctrinal and our tactical response to the problems there. What are those problems? Well, you probably all realize. For one thing, we didn't know how to detect biochemical biological or chemical weapons there. And you might recall, some of you that have read much about it, that the pesky Czechs went over there, and you know they were just out from under the Russian domination, so they were eager to get involved and play a role. This is 91. And Havel and the others sent these Czech detection units over there. And, you know, the Russians are actually, Soviet forces were masters at chemical biological weapons. And I'll talk about another aspect of that in a minute. And so the Czechs went over there with their detection gear and their Fox vehicles, and they were driving all around in the Gulf, and they immediately started finding positive signs of biological or chemical weapons. And you may, some of you may recall this, and my God, the Americans didn't know what to say to this. And the Czechs were saying, you know, sir, it's very strange, but out there on that battlefield, we're finding this level, we're finding that level. All our alarms are being activated. And, of course, what's his name, Norman and the others said, no, it can't be, it's not possible. And the fact, of course, is that we didn't really have even what the Czechs had in terms of detection. And so many, many troops, many of our own troops were exposed when they went out, particularly and detonated these chemical weapons dumps. It's one of the scandals of that war. The Kamiseya alone probably exposed 10 or 12,000 troops. It's just outrageous what was done. And then, of course, for 3 or 4 years, they sat on it. Finally, about 4 years later, in 95, 96, the CIA said, well, you know, we've done some modeling, some computer modeling, and we actually it's possible that that did have, where the winds could have gone this way. You know, and they finally acknowledged and admitted. And then eventually the VA was dragged into it. And they said, well, all right, if you can show you're a Kamiseya, we'll look differently at your disability claim. So that's the one problem. Another problem, of course, you know, was depleted uranium. This was the first time we ever used depleted uranium. That's a radioactive tip to a shell. It's used on tanks, planes, and artillery. And this thing, this stuff, is about 60% of the natural radiation of uranium. So they call it depleted. Sounds good. Sounds like, gee, that's all right. It's not depleted. It's reduced would be a much better adjective. Reduced uranium weapon, but it's depleted uranium weapon. All right. So the DU weapons, you can be sure, these, you read stories in the paper the last couple of days, the bunker busters, those are completely DU bombs. They DU is very peripheric. In other words, it penetrates any surface, and it creates a fire within it, knocks out. That's why we were able to knock out about 1,200 Iraqi tanks and armored cars with no losses, because we'd penetrate the car, and that was the end of it. It would just go up and be consumed. And the problem with this stuff is that it's radioactive dust. And many of our own troops, not to mention the Iraqis, many of our own troops were on these tanks, on these cars afterwards, taking souvenirs, moving around in these areas, dust littered throughout the desert there. And, of course, to this day, we've done absolutely no cleanup. I did bring along a brochure that we published just recently. I've got a lot of them, so everyone should be able to have one. It kind of goes over the questions of DU. And what I think it shows is that the Pentagon, even today with the lip service it makes about troops, and we've got to take care of our people, and the Agent Orange thing will never happen again, and the atomic vets, they'll never be exposed like that again. In fact, when you look at the history and you read, I think, some of the data in here, you'll see that that's not true. These weapons are deadly, they're very effective, and the Pentagon has absolutely no intention of giving them up. And at the same time, they don't even train our troops into how to at least reduce the risk. And so that's another thing we can look for in the near term. The other area, of course, is vaccines. Papers the last few days filled with stuff about anthrax, just filled. And yet, when they wanted to develop a vaccine for the soldiers, for our own people, forget, as I say, forget the Iraqis or the Kuwaitis or anyone else that was there, that wasn't a concern. When they went to do that, what did they do? They went back to a 1970 vaccine that was developed to use with animal hide workers, people that cut, you know, strip basically skin cattle. And this anthrax vaccine is for skin contact, exposure directly to the skin. And this was a very limited study was done actually to get it approved, but it was approved. FDA approved it. So that's the vaccine they're going to use. Well, you know, again, you don't have to be a military strategist to realize, well, wait a minute. Is that how an anthrax weapon would work? You got skins laying on the ground, soldiers will get down, pick them up, and they get No, that wasn't exactly how it's going to work. And it was well known that it's inhalation, which is what you're reading in the paper today, and yesterday, and probably tomorrow. Inhalation is a very different vehicle for exposure than skin. And what we did was, the military did not want to get involved in the whole, shall we say, peer review process, scrutiny, scientific review of another vaccine. So they say, hey, this one here, what? Oh, a cattle, that's all right, we'll take that down off the shelf. And that's what they started giving troops. And one of the heartening things about this, I think this you can take, I hope you'll take some heart from this, is that thousands of young troops, 19 people your age and even younger, 19, 20-year-old kids said, what is in this stuff? What's this for? What will this do to my reproductive future? What will this do? What will the adverse reactions be? And tens of thousands of people said, I'm not taking this stuff. They're in uniform. I'm not talking reservists. I'm talking about people in uniform. The Marines are a center of this opposition. Marine Corps in Japan, hundreds of them said, I'm not taking it. So I take a certain, I don't want to oversell it, but I take a certain heart in that, that people today, unlike my generation, the Vietnam War, I remember working on construction jobs when I was in college, and a lot of guys didn't wear the helmets. I don't need no helmet. That helmet's for sissies. That kind of attitude. Today, you don't see that, and that's a very healthy change. Young people today realize these toxic chemicals have long-term health effects. You can't always tell, and you aren't always sure. And so anyway, what we did at Citizen Soldier and other groups too was we fed them with information using the internet and other ways, and we were able to get really thousands of people to stand up to this. And actually what happened was, you probably know, is the whole program collapsed because the lab that was making it could never really satisfy the FDA about its own production. Leave aside whether it would protect anybody. Then in the middle of this, there's another guy in the press right today, this guy Ken Alabek. And he had some really scary things to say. You might know this name. He's a Kazakhstani who worked for Biopreparat. Biopreparat is the Soviet lab which was in Sverdlovsk, which has now been renamed something else. I can't keep it straight. But under the Soviet Union, it was called Sverdlovsk. And in 1979, someone left the cookers on a little too high one night. Maybe they were making some tacos in the cookers like they did up at the lab in Lansing. And the thing went up. And about 80 people died. So take heart from that. Here's a town of 100,000 people, and only 80 people died from a full-scale venting of anthrax. So what's that say? It says that anthrax, it's not so easy to poison people with anthrax, which is a good thing in general. Us residents of New York City, we like that. But what they found when they went to these cadavers was that they had several different strains of anthrax bacillus in them. So the Russians, not stupid, were saying, hey, wait, we got recombinant DNA. Let's see what we could do with this bacteria. We'll make some other kinds of bacteria. Well, back at Fort Detrick, our great army scientists, you know, our colonels and generals, they're there with the old cow skin, the old bacteria from the 60s, and that's what they're vaccinating people for. Okay, so we got four types just in this very last people. God knows how many other types there are. And that was 1979, so imagine 21 more years of DNA research. Who the hell knows? So the point of it all is, you probably can't vaccinate people. You probably can't. And if you notice in all the pages and pages in the New York Times and Washington Post, there's not any mention right now about this vaccine thing, if you notice. There's a sidebar story about how the vaccine lab's been a mess and they don't know what to do with it. But you don't see anyone saying, oh, line up and get a vaccine shot. Because they realize that you probably can. That's bad news. But hey, we need to know it. Let's not pretend. Let's not say, gee, you're okay now, soldier. You've got the anthrax vaccine in you. Go on out to that battlefield. They're going to set off some weapons out there. You'll be all right. You know. So that's a good thing. Again, it shows how today we can organize, we can get the word out, we can mobilize people. People are not stupid. They understand these things, at least in their general terms. The other thing about the Gulf War, and I'll go on to the future, is that it was represented a new stage of control by the military in the Gulf. And I don't know if you remember this. Some of you might. There's a pretty good book by a guy named John MacArthur who wrote a book about, I don't know the title to it, but it's about the press and the muzzling of the press in the Gulf War. And you may remember this, maybe you don't, that even Walter Cronkite and some of those other guys went down and joined a lawsuit which tried to open up the whole Pentagon process. And what was happening was that they were not essentially giving out any information about what was going on, the bombings, the effects, all these other issues I've already raised. No discussion, nothing. You want to go out and talk to a couple soldiers? Well, you can go and talk to them, and we'll sit right there with you while you talk to them, and you ask them if they're homesick and if they're really ready for this mission, that kind of stuff. And that's what we got in the Gulf War. The other thing they did, which is even more significant from my point of view, is that they put unprecedented controls on soldiers. So they eliminated, you remember in the Vietnam War, soldiers would come back from the war and they would protest, and they would speak out, and they'd say, well, that's not true what they're saying. Well, I fought in that war. That war was genocidal. That war was this or that. That was very, very upsetting over the long term to our military. And they didn't allow that. So the rules were, no, there will be no ETSing. No one will get out of the Gulf War. So if that war had gone on for 2 years, you would have had no discharges. I mean, you come home in a box or maybe to a hospital, and that's it. The other thing they did was they completely stripped away the rights of people to file CO claims. You probably remember this. And people would file COs, and then one of the things you're supposed to do with a CO claim is once you make the claim, they're supposed to assign you to something that doesn't, you know, any conflict with your stated beliefs anymore. It has to. They aren't supposed to hand you an M16 and say, okay, soldier, get out there and defend that perimeter. They're supposed to give you some other job. Well, they didn't do that at all. A lot of people were isolated. They sent them over. There were some terrible stories of abuse that I don't have time to go into. But the point we have is that and that's the theme kind of citizen soldiers. This is our military. These are our citizens. They're citizens first. And they should not be treated in this kind of totally arbitrary and unconstitutional way. So that's the other part of the Gulf War, because they thought, we'll learn from Vietnam, we won't let a movement grow up of people criticizing what we're doing, or maybe the deaths or civilian deaths or anything like that. We just won't let it happen. So we'll see that again with this war, and you see it right now with the media. Well, partly they're helped because it's so remote and so difficult that there's very little media access anyway, as you know. So now I'd like to go to the question of what I see is the possible, maybe even probable evolution here. We know that Bush has said this is going to be a long war. This is not going to end tomorrow. There's not going to be any easy, as Don Rumsfeld said, there'll be no signing on the battle on the deck of the Missouri. No surrender signing. No. Oh, really, Don? Okay. So that's what they're getting you ready for. Open-ended, real vague and indeterminate, long-term. And so who's going to define victory? Big question. All right, so here's how I see it. Let me just get a sip of water here. First phase will be what we're in now. That's air, heavy air. We're good at that. Oh, boy, we got those B-52s, man. They can fly all the way from Missouri, all the way over there without even... Well, they got to fuel up a little more, but no problem, man. Drop those 2,000 or 3,000 pound bombs, daisy cutters. I told you already about the bunker busters. You know, we got all these great names. Napalm, you'll see, start seeing anything we need. All right, so that's phase one. Lots of air insertion up high. Hope they don't get shot down by any of those stingers that we gave them back in the 70s. You know, if you stay below, I guess you stay above 12, 14,000 feet, a stinger probably can't hit you. And those B-52s, they fly 35, 40,000 feet up. But there's anti-aircraft batteries. Maybe who knows what else they got over there. And so you'll probably see before too long a few of these planes going down. Then the whole frenzy will be like it was in Yugoslavia. Remember, let's get that pilot back. We've got to get him back. And so the 1,000 people in Uzbekistan now are supposedly on guard just to get retrieval of pilots. That's their job right now, they say. Okay. Then you'll see commando raids. This is still in phase one. Some of you may have read, and the rest of you should take the time to read a book called Black Hawk Down. You might have heard of it. It's a bestseller. It's a best paperback bestseller right now by a guy named Mark Bowen, who is a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Black Hawk Down is about a four-day period in Mogadishu back in 93. And Mogadishu was, you know, a little bit, yeah, I wouldn't say I'm no expert, but I don't think it's so hell of a lot different from Kandahar or Jalalabad or even Kabul. And anyway, this was a disaster. I won't go into it, but it was Delta Force leads the charge. These are guys whose training is so secret that when you go, as I've been to Fort Bragg a number of times on cases, you try to get a press officer at Fort Bragg. This isn't a democracy now. You try to get a press officer at Fort Bragg, you say, God, Captain, you've really been helpful here today. Do you think tomorrow afternoon we got a recess? Do you think maybe we could go out and take a look at some of that Delta Force training? Ooh, what training? I don't know it. No, I'm not clear to even talk about it. It's totally secret, classified. I'm not kidding you. You go down to Fort Bragg and check it out. So this guy in the book even says, you know, I could only analyze some of their tactics because I don't know about all of them. And I only got two of the people even talk to me. And they've been silenced by the others and ostracized. Okay, this is the Delta Force that's going to do this. I've laid out enough sarcasm here. But the point is, this stuff sounds good. And when Bruce Willis is rappelling down a helicopter rope, it looks great. You know, and the rippling muscles, and man, he's got the black all painted around his face. Man, it's great. But reality, different. Ask any Vietnam vet, they'll tell you that. Gulf War vet even, they'll tell you that. Reality's different. So that's going to be the other part of phase one. Commandos, inserting people. We'll capture, who is it? Well, we'll capture somebody. We'll take them out. We'll bring them out. Remember in Mogadishu, we're going to get ID'd, the warlord. We're going to get him. Well, they never even got close to ID. They never even found out where he was. And we lost 20 people. It was a disaster, as I said. This thing is going to make that look like a Sunday afternoon in Horseshoe Square Park. Okay, so that's the phase one in my prediction. The second part will be phase two. These won't necessarily be, we will not be told we're going into the new phase. Oh, no. But it'll start to happen. So all of a sudden, phase two is generally an expansion of these types of tactics into other parts of the region. You've already heard a little bit about this. He said, we'll go wherever we have to. I'm talking like him now. We'll go wherever we have to go. No one should feel they're safe. I'm getting like Nixon here. If they're doing anything, they can better be wary, because we will go wherever they are and take the battle to them. That's the kind of theme, right? All right. So phase two will be, all of a sudden, we'll be talking about, we got to go into the Sudan. I wouldn't rule out going into South Lebanon. I wouldn't rule out parts of, like, Chechen. Sounds familiar. Well, Putin's going to get something for this, right? Putin, Prime Minister of Soviet Russia. He's going to get something. He's got a nasty problem in Chechen with these Muslims. And he's going to, you don't be surprised, or even in Uzbekistan, it's got their own problems. So you'll see commando raids then start to take place in other places. And they'll be in concert with our, quote, allies. And you know, you can imagine where that can lead. If our allies are the Israelis. If our allies are some other rump group in Sudan or this National Alliance. You know, very interesting about the National Alliance. They talk about how the National Alliance, that's a, you know, an alternative to the Taliban. Well, there's a story just last week in one of the British papers, who do, as you know, a much better job of covering these things than we do here. And they had a story about how the National Alliance got into a serious contretemps with some UN observers because 200 Taliban tried to surrender to them, and they mowed them all down. Just mowed them down. So, you know, I mean, let's not have any illusions about who these folks are, who our allies are going to be. All right. So that's phase two, I think. God knows where that will lead. God knows how much mobilization. But still, we still will not have ground forces, conventional operations. There still will not be that. It'll be this idea. But before long, of course, that'll become a question. We can't hold this terrain. Commandos don't hold terrain. They go in, they take people, they knock out things, and they leave. So if you want to try to change the politics of a given area, you're going to have to do something else, which means conventional force. Now, the third part of it, and this is scary, but I don't think it's I don't think I'm being hyperbolic here. You keep seeing these references to Saddam, to Iraq. You know, back in 91, we just should have kept going on right up that road. We should have taken care of these folks. What's the word I think Colin Powell used, or maybe one of the other generals? Take the head off the viper, something like that. Johnson said, we're going to nail the coonskin to the cabin wall. That was his. Well, let's just take the head off the viper. Okay, so that may be our third phase, will be a much larger, and that, of course, would require major conventional operations. You can't go into, and no matter what condition of the Iraqi military, you cannot go into a country of that size and begin to move around even if you're willing to take casualties, you'd have enormous problems. So we may be looking toward down the road, and this may be not in months, it may not even be in the next year, that kind of movement. Because if you think about the logic follows, we got to knock out terrorism. We keep redefining who they are. We keep finding new elements of it. It's broader than we thought. Maybe it's not just Al-Qaeda. Maybe it's other. Maybe it's state-sponsored. And that shift takes place, and then we will be in a situation which all bets are off. And compared to Vietnam, remember Vietnam, the technology was much lower then. Troops went to Vietnam in boats. Yeah, they used to go to Vietnam in boats, take 2 weeks to get there. Not anymore. Weapons, vastly more powerful, vastly more dangerous. Like I said, the depleted uranium, other weapons. So you've got a much more deadly, lethal environment. You've got all these chemicals in use. And so it's going to be, we could be looking towards something that's very, very fearful. And unlike really anything we've lived through, you can't look back to Vietnam or to the Gulf and say, oh, those are some precedents. How did that turn out? It may not really be. It may be of a whole different order of magnitude. And I'd say this to close, that this is where we need to place, you know, this should drive us forward. And we need to commit ourselves and draw on people. We've got to build this movement now. And the final little point I'll make is that don't think ever that these soldiers, people that have volunteered, don't think and don't understand and don't draw the same conclusions that we do. They don't have the same information, and they're subjected to massive amounts of brainwashing, especially in the airborne and the marine units. They're really heavily brainwashed. But they are accessible to us in many ways. We need to always keep those channels open, as lines open with them, support them. And I think over time we can hopefully stop this juggernaut.
That was Todd Ensign, Director of Citizen Soldier.
Our next speaker is Christian Parenti. He's the author of Lockdown America, Police and Prisons in the Age of Crisis. Right now he is writing a book about the history of surveillance. He's a teacher at New College at California.
Thank you very much to everybody who organized this. Thanks for the invitation. Was asked to talk about the civil liberties aspect of this war, and I'm also going to say something about the role of American empire in the larger problem that we face, which is, you know, terrorism and endless war, it seems. To start with the civil liberties aspect, as you all probably know, there was this series of bills proposed immediately after this happened, right? Administration devised their wish list, basically a fascist fantasy list, and it was proposed as the ATA, the Anti-Terrorism Act, went to the House, became the Patriot Act, which had some absurd acronym about fighting terrorism, and it was watered down there. If you want to be generous, you could say it was watered down by John Conyers. It wasn't really watered down that much. And then it went to the Senate, where it became the USA Act, which is the Uniting and Strengthening America Act. And it passed the Senate on Friday, basically untouched from what the administration has proposed. So, and the argument is that we have to do this. This is a crisis. We've been attacked, and we certainly have been attacked, and this is a tremendous calamity. And it's not all lies when Ashcroft says, you know, there could be more attacks. I mean, of course, he uses that cynically, right? When was that 3-day period that the attacks might happen? And I'm sure there were anthrax things that may be connected to Al-Qaeda. But why was he hyping that up? Because that's when this was passing through the Senate. So before we even get into what the USA Act does, we should deal with what powers the U.S. government already had before this to investigate and prosecute crimes. First and foremost, they had lots of money, right? I mean, the FBI is an enormous organization, $3.5 billion budget, close to 12,000 field agents, and that's just, you know, the main federal agents. You got the DEA and all these others. In May, they gave $10 billion to federal agencies to fight terrorism, May of this year. In terms of legal powers, there's pre-existing statutes that give the government tremendous power that were then beefed up in 96. Foremost among these are the right to tap telephones, right? You're all familiar with this. The two ways you do this are, one, Title III of the U.S. Criminal Code, which is the standard way you're supposed to get a wiretap. And what you have to do to use Title III is you have to, as if you're an investigator, you have to prove that you have exhausted all other methods for getting the information. You have to show probable cause that the target of the tap is really involved in a crime. And then on top of those two things, if those are proven, you then have to show that the tap itself will be useful. So you can't just tap the subject's mother or grandmother's telephone if there's no material connection. So there's another way to get a telephone tap since 1978, and that's through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And in that case, investigators can gather information to use in foreign intelligence operations and therefore not to use in criminal court, where the standards of proof would be higher. And all they have to have there is reasonable suspicion that there is something going on and that there's a foreign intelligence angle to it. Currently, there are more Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act taps granted every year than there are Title III taps. And these are basically automatic. They are actually automatic. There's no judicial review. A judge has to give federal investigators a FISA tap as soon as they certify a foreign intelligence connection. And thus, they get them all the time. Well, not all the time, actually, because there's one documented case in 20 years of a FISA tap being turned down. So then what they do with FISA, the information there, is then they can build probable cause to get a Title III tap or to search your house or whatever and build a case against you. Another thing they already had before the laws that are now up was the material witness law, which you've all heard about but probably hasn't been explained that well. The material witness law allows the federal government in the investigation of a crime to detain, to arrest people who have nothing to do with the crime necessarily. They're not suspects. They're people who may have important information. That's what a material witness is. And they have over 600 people detained, many of them not even talking to their lawyers, on this material witness desk. Those people are not suspects. They're material witnesses. There's also the grand jury, which is used all the time. When you're called before, they impanel a grand jury. If you're called before a grand jury, you have to answer its questions. If you do not answer the questions, you will go to jail. And then you will pay fines and you will do jail time. And this is the investigation of a crime. This is not the prosecution of a crime. In terms of immigration, they already essentially had unlimited detention. There was actually a lot of case law around that. And then just in the end of the summer, the Supreme Court said you cannot detain an immigrant indefinitely. You have to, within a short period of time, I think it was like a week, charge them with a deportable offense and then try and deport them. But in reality, what would happen is that people would be deemed deportable, and then if their country doesn't want to take them back, they just live in detention forever. And there are thousands of Cubans, for example, who were deemed deportable, and Cubans don't want them back, and other nationals too, Russians and other countries. So there already was essentially indefinite detention. Since the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, another little feature of the immigration law they had was the use of secret evidence. Any immigrant can be detained on secret evidence, which they do not have a right to access. And the interesting thing about that is it doesn't get used that often, and we can talk about that later. Another thing they set up in 96 were secret terrorist courts, which they also don't use, which is interesting to discuss. So anyway, what are they going to get? What are they getting from this? They further merge the FISA and Title III. So they recognize legally the FBI's interpretation of FISA, and they allow the use of FISA more readily in regular investigations. There is legalization of interagency information sharing, which means that the CIA has the right to build dossiers and to investigate Americans here in America, which was, in the beginning of last week, illegal. There is an expansion of pen registration tap and trace laws. Now, this is similar to the FISA warrant. To get a pen registration tap and trace warrant, it's an administrative warrant is really what it is. You don't have to go to a judge if you're an investigator. You just certify that there is a need, and then the judge automatically gives, with no review, the right to log the numbers that a telephone calls. Now, not tap the content, but just to make a chart of what numbers are connecting to what telephone numbers. The FBI have already been using this to track internet use, and there's a big difference, because looking at telephone numbers is very different from looking at websites and email addresses, which have subject headings connected to them. Websites have names and histories. The FBI can then go to that website on its own, right? That's totally free to see what you're looking at. So that will now be legal, and that will be automatic. There'll be no warrant involved in that. They have legalized sneak and peek warrants, secret warrants. Currently, if there's a search of your house, they break in, they search, they have to leave you a copy of the warrant so that you have the right to contest the conditions of that warrant. So if they have the right to search the first floor of your house, there's the case right here in New York a lot of you are probably familiar with, where the Hells Angels were searched and the cops were videotaping themselves searching. And they searched the down here on whatever it is in the Lower East Side. They were searching the first floor, And they say, should we go upstairs? And they say, well, what does the warrant say? And they're like, that doesn't matter. Let's go upstairs. And in fact, the warrant said only the first floor. So that case was thrown out. So currently, they're supposed to leave you a copy of the warrant so you can see. Well, did they search only what the warrant says? Did they violate their own warrant? And then you can fight it in court. Under the new sneak and peek, they can keep secret for 90 days the fact that they've even broken into your house and rifled through your material. There's a new definition, essentially, of being a hacker. Anyone who uses gains unauthorized access to computer systems, which is like not the same as breaking into a computer system. And if there's deemed unauthorized use of computer information or of a computer system, rather, federal investigators can automatically, without a judge giving them a warrant, start an investigation of hackers or even people who, you know, are messing around in places they shouldn't be on computer systems. There's roving FISA taps now. So when you get a FISA tap for an individual, you can tap every communication that every communications technology they use. So if you have an activist, you want a FISA tap on them, if you're an agent here, and they use the public library's internet access, they can tap and trace everything happening on the public library's internet system. And all of the person's friends, they can tap not just when the person who is subject to the warrant emails a friend or contacts a friend, but then all of those people who are contacted as well, can their communications can be monitored. There's also warrantless access to business records. Certain class of business records have to be turned over. Credit records have to be turned over without a warrant, and education records. Previously, the feds had the right to find out if you were enrolled in a school, your name, your date of birth. That was it. But now they have the right to get access to what classes you take. So you could imagine, right, if one wants to be paranoid, you could imagine how they could start looking for everybody who's studying Introduction to Marxism and build a list that might be useful for something. And most frightening of all is the new definition of a terrorist. A terrorist is anyone, among other things that are obviously terroristic, is anyone who violates a federal or state law in a way that may cause harm to people in the pursuit, and they violate the law in the pursuit of making political change. I think it's getting darker and darker in here, or my glaucoma is kicking in or something. So that's clearly about activists, right? You got to keep in mind, right? Who was the FBI thinking about the day before these planes hit the World Trade Center? They were thinking about the anti-globalization movement, right? They were gearing up for a big protest in New York. We have the quotes from May of Louis Free describing terrorists, describing Reclaim the Streets, describing anarchists in Seattle as people who are, you know, part of a potentially domestic terrorist scene. So anyway, it's a horrible law, right? But lest you get too paranoid, it's important to remember that the law is not simply language designed by politicians or lawyers. The law, the lived life of the law, is determined by the balance of power between the people and the state. Take, for example, the case of secret evidence against immigrants. The fact of the matter is they hardly ever use that. They use it about 10 times a year out of 300 procedures. Why is that? You know, I mean, think about it. There are people in the FBI who would love to go to SEIU and find all the Salvadorian organizers and detain them on secret evidence and get them out of here, right? But they can't do that. And they can't do that because every time they do use secret evidence, they get attacked by the left. And we should take heart in that. And they get attacked by very competent left-wing lawyers who fight them tooth and nail and are actually establishing case law, which is rolling back their right to use secret evidence. More to the point, there isn't the ideological, cultural climate to endorse that kind of action, that kind of behavior by the government. Part of the reason is because the left has worked diligently to create a space to defend civil liberties. And another part of it is that the right wing is having a little bit of blowback domestically of its own. They have for 30 years been running against government, right? The function of running against government for the Republicans is to get people to endorse capital gains tax and slashing regulation for big corporations. But that project is dressed up with this idea of individual freedom. And the grassroots right wing believes that part of it. They're not really invested in the capital gains tax. Frequently, they don't even understand that that's the real agenda behind the anti-government thing. And so they think it's actually about the Fourth Amendment, right? protection against undue search and seizure. And so you have people like Bob Barr in the House, a horrible, horrible right winger, coming out and criticizing the bill. And if any of you listen to right-wing talk radio the week that this started coming down, it was full of people just railing against this stuff, doing a much better job than many liberals, it might be said.